Welcome to Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. Today we preview the upcoming Yellow Springs Film Festival. I had a chance to speak with Eric Mahoney, founder, festival director, and chief programmer for the event, which returns to Yellow Springs October 2nd through the 5th. This is the third year for the festival, which features film showings, conversations with filmmakers, actors, and industry professionals, plus comedy, music, and more. Most of the festival's events take place in the Foundry Theater on the Antioch College campus and the Little Art Theater in downtown Yellow Springs. You can see a complete schedule at ysfilmfest.com. In the second part of today's program, we will feature a talk session from last fall's festival between Mahoney and film director Jim Jarmusch. This fall's festival begins with events on Thursday, October 2nd, which celebrate the legacy of writer, producer, and Antioch College graduate Rod Serling. I began my chat with Eric Mahoney by asking how the celebration of Rod Serling became a part of this year's festival.
It was interesting. There was an organization called Ohio Goes to the Movies that reached out right after we launched the festival, kind of seen about partnering around some events. And Rod Serling was someone on the top of my personal list as someone to highlight at the festival, certainly because, again, of his Antioch roots, and I'm a huge Twilight Zone fan. They had actually reached out and kind of mentioned they had been in touch with his daughter, Anne, and were thinking about doing some sort of event, kind of memorializing his career, and would we be interested in partnering because of our juxtaposition to Antioch and so forth. So it just really aligned very quickly like that. I was thrilled to get the call. And so, yeah, we've kind of been working on this event with Ohio and a Library Association, Antioch College, Ohio Goes to the Movies now for well over a year. And it kind of gave us the opportunity to start the festival a day early this year. So on Thursday, the 2nd, there will be a marker dedication for Rod Serling at Antioch College campus, followed by an event that the film festival then will be hosting at the Foundry Theater that evening, which we're just sort of saying is a tribute to Rod Serling. And it's kind of played out as a really interesting mashup. So we're doing two guest speakers. His daughter Anne is one of them. She's going to be giving a half hour presentation about her relationship with her father. We found a radio play that Rod Serling authored during his time in Antioch, which we have then cast with a group of really wonderful actors, and we'll be performing that evening as a radio play. So that's something that's really interesting that we haven't done before at the festival, is kind of a live theater presentation. And then we're going to screen a classic Twilight Zone episode and have a panel discussion with some other people to round out the evening, to kind of talk about his career at the Twilight Zone, its massive influence on pop culture, and probably, arguably any showrunner, director, producer, I think, would probably list him as an influence. And I don't think that's too grandiose of a comment. He's that sort of influential with his writing, and the Twilight Zone being that compelling of a series that touches upon, the human condition and politics and morality and, so many different things. So I think he's just, he's just one of the quintessential biggest talents in film and television in terms of storytelling. And so, we're really honored to just be a part of this and to pay tribute to him and his legacy.
Before we continue, I'll mention that for more information on the Rod Serling Historical Marker and the Antioch College Yellow Springs connection to the Serling legacy, check out Jerry Kenney's interview with Antioch College archivist Scott Sanders at wyso.org. Eric, from the start, the Yellow Springs Film Festival has featured comedy. This year, you have Kevin Nealon in your lineup, and you're also featuring a live comedy podcast that features Michael Ian Black. If you could, talk a bit about how comedy fits into your programming mission and what you have planned this year.
I'm a lifelong fan of stand-up comedy. Truly, really a deep fan of all things stand-up. So my appreciation for that art form is very deep. And, I think that, again, part of the bigger creative around the festival is connectivity and bringing people together. And I think that laughter does that better than almost anything. And so to start the festival each year with a kickoff party with a stand-up comic has been now a blueprint that we like to use, because I think there's no better way to do it. The energy in that room on a matinee for a Friday afternoon to start the festival with these comics that we've been doing, Fred Armisen, and you mentioned Reggie Watts, and now Kevin Nealon, has just been an exceptional, fun way to kick off the festival, and it puts it in the right vibe immediately. And so, you know, anytime I can fuse in comedy in the festival and live music for that matter, I'm all for. So I think that, you know, we're always looking to do that. The Novelizers podcast is another example of that. Steven Levinson, who is a Dayton native, but he spent a lot of time in New York. He was a writer on The Tonight Show. He started this podcast where he and comedy writers take like classic films and rework them as a comedic retelling of them, and have different actors and comedians, you know, read chapters from the novelized version of the film. And so, yeah, we're going to do a live podcast reading with that. Michael Ian Black is someone I've been a fan of a long time. I love The State, Stella, and he will be one of the featured guests for that reading. Layla Ingalls is a local comic who's on the rise, who is also opening the Kevin Nealon set. So she will be doing the Novelizers podcast. Kate Carter is a local musician who will be on there. And then Rich Carrillo is an actor from New York City who's coming down to do the Rod Serling play. And then he's going to stick around the next day and be a part of that Novelizers podcast too. So I think that's going to be a really fun event, something we haven't done before. Again, we're venturing out into a little bit of live theater and podcast this year. So I love that we have this variety of offerings, you know. So yeah, long-winded answers. I love comedy, and I think bringing that and infusing that in the festival is a wonderful addition, and just really sets the tone.
People who have attended the festival by this time know they're going to see new works from both the documentary and narrative film realms. You often have directors and actors on hand to talk about the work. Later in today's program, we're featuring a talk session you did last fall with director Jim Jarmusch. Let's talk about some of the films and talk sessions you have planned for this year's event.
For me, it's arguably the most enjoyable part of all this. You know, that's what I loved about being a documentary filmmaker, too, is interviewing people. And when I had a podcast, I really enjoy that process and talking to artists. So for me, during the festival, to sit down with people that I really admire is a real honor, and it's a lot of fun. Kevin Smith obviously has been someone that's been really important to me since the 90s. Clerks was really a game changer for me. You know, that I think that aligned with my age properly, but you know, that was an eye opener for me in terms of independent filmmaking. And I think he's just great. He's hilarious, and he's a huge talent. And Dogma is a wonderful film with just a massive cast of insanely talented people. So I'm really thrilled to be talking with him about that and screening that film as an anniversary. Certainly speaking with Hannah Beekler is going to be a big thrill as well. She is just a remarkable talent and someone that's local, and we're so lucky that she's, you know, represents our region. For those that don't know, she's an Oscar award-winning production designer. She works with Ryan Coogler. So most recently she's done Sinners. She did Black Panther. She did Wakanda Forever, Miles Ahead. She worked on Moonlight, which was Best Picture, the Rocky franchise, the new Ryan Coogler Rocky franchise films. She is just an absolute powerhouse and a creative genius, in my opinion. So she'll be there to do an in conversation on Sunday, followed by our closing night film, which is Matt and Tom Berninger. Matt is the lead singer of the band The National from Cincinnati. He and his brother made a documentary a few years ago, kind of about their relationship. It's a kind of a music doc, but it's Mask is a music doc. It's really about, you know, two brothers' relationship. And it's one of my favorite docs from the last few years. It's one that kind of fell through the cracks. I think it was the opening night film at Tribeca. And, you know, it played all the festivals. And it's just a brilliant, brilliant film. Tom is the director, and Matt is sort of the star of the film alongside of his brother. And it's a beautiful portrait of these two brothers who are very different, but have this bond. And, we're lucky to have both of them attend and talk about it afterwards for closing night. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And then quickly, I'll add Audrey Zahn will be there for opening night. She is the star of a new film called She Dances that just premiered at Tribeca. It co-stars Ethan Hawke and her father, Steve Zahn, who has been at the festival before. And it's a beautiful film. It's a wonderful 90-minute narrative starring those three. And she'll be on hand afterwards, and we'll be able to interview her and talk about, you know, kind of her first experience in a leading role in a film. All these things I'm very much looking forward to, having these conversations for sure.
Music documentaries have been a cornerstone of the Yellow Springs Film Festival. And you have a new film from Stanley Nelson and Nicole London called We Want the Funk, with both filmmakers in attendance, plus a party to go with it this year, right?
Absolutely. And shout out to WISO for being our presenting sponsor of that event. Since I will be at the Foundry then, Steve Bognar who will be hosting that Q&A. We sort of have these blueprints now. So Saturday night now at the Little Art seems to be sort of like music doc night. We had 32 Sounds first year with Sam Green, and Steve interviewed Sam. And then last year we had the Eno documentary in that slot, and Steve interviewed Gary Hustwit, who was in town. And then this year Steve will be doing the interview for the funk documentary, which is a deep dive into that genre and how it has influenced, you know, pop culture and many other different genres. It even goes to Fela Kuti in Africa and David Byrne and the rock scene in like the 80s. And I mean, it just goes all over the place and traces the lineage of funk music and how influential it is. I can't personally do all these interviews or see all of them. So I will say that it's going to be an exceptional night.
You mentioned Steve Bognar hosting the talk session for We Want the Funk. He's been involved with the Yellow Springs Film Festival from the start, and he's also hosting an event of his own on Saturday morning.
He is, and I'm really grateful that we have that kind of talent that's available to us. And he's been so generous with his time. And yes, we'll be conducting a free educational seminar Saturday morning at the Foundry Theater for anyone that wants to come by. It's a talk, primarily about documentary filmmaking. You can ask questions. He will take a deep dive into sort of his process and go through lots of tools of the trade for nonfiction filmmaking. I would highly suggest going, if you are a filmmaker, if you're a doc filmmaker, frankly, even if you're just interested in film, he's just such a formidable talent and has such a wealth of knowledge and experience that, I would sit and listen to that even if I wasn't, personally an artist. I think it would just be a wonderful talk. So, yeah, if anyone's interested, that's free to the public. And Steve is a real asset and someone that I'm very, very grateful for their time and input into the festival.
Another related key piece is the Julia Reichert Award, which is presented each year at the event. This year, the event is hosted by Julia's first filmmaking collaborator, Jim Klein. Tell us about this year's recipient and a bit about the award.
Every year we will be giving a $3,000 prize to an emerging female documentarian. It's presented by PNC, and they're our partner on that, and I'm really grateful for them, and they provide the prize. Shout out to them and much gratitude for their help in supporting young artists. This year, the winner is Claudia Owusu. She is a documentary filmmaker who is Columbus-based, so it's giving back to sort of the Ohio local artist community too, which feels great. Her project is a wonderful piece that was submitted to us. We'll kind of share more about that at the event and kind of give an overview of what her film is going to be. I think the creative around this moving forward is that we will screen a Julia Reichert film at these events as well. So we will both kind of announce the winner and talk about their project and then sit and watch a classic Julia Reichert film. This year it's going to be Growing Up Female, which is co-directed by Jim Klein, who will be there. Last year we screened Stephen Bognar's film Julia Stepping Stones, which felt appropriate to kind of kick off that award. But I think moving forward, we'll be screening a Julia Reichert film each year in conjunction with the award. It's really meaningful for us to kind of keep Julia's legacy alive here in the village and the film community, and then to also empower a younger artist to to make new work. So we're really just proud to be, you know, a part of that.
With the deep legacy of documentary filmmakers right here in the region, showcasing new documentary films has been another important part of your mission. I know you have a new documentary about comedian Marc Maron on the schedule. Tell us about some of the other films you have on the schedule this year.
The doc slate this year is my favorite to date. It's really, really strong. You mentioned the Marc Maron documentary, Are We Good? It's a really fascinating portrait of him processing loss and kind of, you know, just kind of evaluating where he is in life. It's a really interesting piece. Premiered at South By, it was at Tribeca. Agent of Happiness is a beautiful film that I saw last year at True False. It is in the country of Bhutan. They have literal agents of happiness that go around and interview citizens of the country to measure their happiness, which is kind of a bizarre thing in and of itself. But then the film is documents that, but also follows one of these agents and, you know, in his grappling with his own personal happiness and dissatisfaction. And so it's a beautiful film. I would highly recommend seeing that. Prime Minister is also something I'm really proud to have. The Jacinda Ardern documentary about her time in office as Prime Minister of New Zealand during the pandemic. She has a child while she's in office. She grapples with the COVID outbreak, gun violence, very big, heavy issues, all while being a parent and leader of a country. It's all filmed in real time during her presidency, and it's a fantastic portrait.
Let's squeeze in some other mentions of narrative films that are on the slate this year, and tell us a bit about your short films program.
Fantasy Life is one that I absolutely love. It stars Amanda Peet. She's really just knocks this out of the park. It's a wonderful kind of comedy drama. Again, it was a South by Southwest premiere. That did win the audience award. I can say that for sure on this one. Great film about a kind of a younger struggling person who connects with a little bit older woman than he is, who's also struggling in life in different ways. And they kind of have this forge this friendship and connection that's really quite beautiful. There's a film called Magic Hour. It stars Katie Asselton. She also co-wrote it with her husband, Mark Duplass, who I'm a big fan of. It stars David Diggs from Hamilton fame. It's a really wonderful, again, kind of mysterious film in a lot of ways. You're not really sure what's happening for a while, and then it unfolds and you kind of see it as a bit of a twist. But it's a really good kind of quiet film, small cast, and very meditative. We have a foreign film called Ravens, which is really fantastic, kind of a surrealistic period piece. About a Japanese photographer that I'm a big fan of. It premiered at the Tokyo International Film Festival. Producer Orianne Williams will be here to speak about that afterwards. That's a really fun, interesting ride, that film. If you have time to check that out, I would really recommend it. It's quite unique in its storytelling and visuals. It's really beautiful. Yeah, our shorts program is always something we spend a lot of time curating, and it's basically a mix of doc and narrative. Last year we had some animation in there actually, but it's usually a 50-50 kind of doc narrative split. But I watch a lot of shorts during the year and kind of try to put together a really nice mix that play well together. This year is no exception. It's really phenomenal. I actually plucked, I think, three of these out of Sundance this year, because the Sundance shorts this year were really impressive to me. And then we got a few submissions. This year was the first year that we actually took submissions to the film festival and found some of our shorts that way, which was great to find some new talent that we weren't, you know, aware of. So the shorts, I believe, is Saturday morning or early afternoon. And that's always a real big crowd favorite, and something I would really recommend checking out.
Another reminder that you can see a complete Yellow Springs Film Festival schedule at ysfilmfest.com. Eric, thanks again for taking the time out to speak with me for Think Twice. We're looking forward to it. Good luck on the event this year.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
The Yellow Springs Film Festival takes place October 2nd through the 5th. Most events take place at the Foundry Theater on the Antioch College campus and the Little Art Theater in downtown Yellow Springs. The after party following the Saturday screening of We Want the Funk will be hosted by WYSO with music provided by DJ Lady Bounce. at the Foundry Theater. Once again, you can see complete information on the Yellow Springs Film Festival at ysfilmfest.com. After this break, we will be back with a talk session from last fall's Yellow Springs Film Festival with Eric Mahoney and director Jim Jarmusch. This is Think Twice on WYSO.
Do I really know the history of Ohio?
Hi, I'm Nina Ellis.
And I'm Chris Welter.
That was Chief Glenna Wallace from the Eastern Shawnee Tribe of Oklahoma speaking on WYSO's new podcast, The Ohio Country.
If you haven't listened to all 12 episodes yet, you can find The Ohio Country wherever you get podcasts.
And if you have listened, please rate and review The Ohio Country on Apple Podcasts so more people can find it. Thanks.
Welcome back to Think Twice. Today the focus is on the Yellow Springs Film Festival. We began by previewing this year's event. In our second segment, we feature a talk session with Festival Chief Programmer Eric Mahoney and Film Director Jim Jarmusch, which took place at last fall's event. This edited interview took place at the Foundry Theater on the Antioch College campus in Yellow Springs, following a screening of the 1999 Jim Jarmusch film Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. While I had Eric on the phone for the conversation about this year's festival, I asked him to provide a brief setup to the interview from a year ago.
Jim is one of my favorite directors of all time. When I moved to New York in 2006, some way I had zero experience. I was starting completely at the bottom, but I thought, well, if I could just intern for someone that I love, that would be really cool. And it just so worked out that I was able to do that. And so through that process, I got to know him a little bit and was able to stay in touch. And, he's just an incredible person, too, as well as an artist. And he's been very supportive of me and all of my endeavors, including this festival. When this launched, he was kind of the first person I saw on Instagram that was liking our posts and, being very supportive. And that meant a great deal to me. And so, last year I was trying to think of, how we could possibly get him out to the festival. I knew that his new film wasn't going to be ready yet, but looking at the back catalog, which is so substantial, I saw there was, an anniversary for Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. And so reached out and, asked if that was something he'd be interested in screening again and talking about. And it was. And so, and again, I'm really grateful for Jim's support in terms of, my career and what I've been up to. And he's always been there to help and lend a hand. And I'm really grateful for that.
Jim Jarmusch.
Thank you. I should have come out a minute ago because there's something I'm very proud of. At the very end, there's a red graffiti-styled writing of Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai by Phase Two, one of the greatest graffiti writers in New York style. And I got him to do that as a kind of special little treat for the end of the film. He's not with us anymore, but long live Phase Two.
It's incredible. It's lovely.
And in the history of graffiti writers of the New York style, he's revered now like any graffiti writer in New York. So I was very proud to get that from him.
In our second year, I just want to say I don't like to speak on behalf of anyone, let alone a room full of people, but I feel empowered to at this point and just say it's an embarrassment of riches to have you at the Yellow Springs Film Festival this early on. Truly.
Thank you. I can understand the embarrassment part of it, but no, thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm here because of this guy, and also just the kind of miraculous idea of a little garden like this being nurtured and sprouting, and thank all of you. I have to say, whenever I make a film, always I've adamantly never made it for an audience. The people I collaborate with, we try to make something we would like, and we never want to think about, what's the target demographic? but having said that, the film doesn't exist. It's like an electric current, and if you build a lamp, until you plug it in and turn it on, there's no thing there. So it's, reaching anyone, and, literally dozens of people have seen my films. All around the world.
Possibly hundreds.
So that's kind of cool, anyway. Just saying. I don't know.
Well, that sense. There's two things that come to mind actually when you say that around the sense of collaboration, right? One is we were actually just talking about this backstage a little bit about how in nature birds that fly in certain elaborate formations can do things that they can't do by themselves, and we were talking about that in terms of art and collaboration, and this film. Strikes me as a strong collaboration of an amalgamation of ideas with hip hop culture and samurai culture and New York culture and gangster culture. And I just wanted to, I guess, talk about the genesis of how you sort of kind of came up with that mashup of all these different types of cultural components to build this story from.
Well, sort of inadvertently, because I'm a self-proclaimed dilettante. I know a lot of details about a lot of things because there are too many incredible things on this planet. So I'm an amateur mycologist. I know the history of European motorcycle design. You know, I know about French symbolist poetry. I'm into hardcore gangster hip-hop, underground hip-hop, electronic music, etc. So this is a kind of collage, in a way, of influences, of inspirations. I've always been a crime film and crime fiction aficionado since I was a teenager. And I love crime films, I love the crime, and I love many genres, you know, but the criminal one is like, you know, they're morally ambiguous, there are two sides of the law, they're often at night, film noir, there's a darkness both literally and figuratively, you know, existentially, whatever. Oh, I have a question. What's the difference between, who knows the difference between ignorance and apathy? Thank you. The answer is I don't know and I don't care. So. You win, I don't know what you win, but thank you, you're the winner. What does he get, Eric?
Well, last night we had door prizes for the Pulp Fiction thing, so we're fresh.
Yes, so you can claim your giant basket of nothing after the... Anyway, sorry, where was we? I got sidetracked by my own...
I don't know.
Dilettantism.
A mashup. Yeah.
So, there's crime fiction, then there's hip-hop music. I like the experimental side. I was a Wu-Tang fan from the beginning. But, you know, there are also Nas and Eric B. and Rakim, and there's a lot of things that, to me, blew open, you know, that genre. So when I was writing the film, I would get DJ vinyl of Wu-Tang stuff where that just had the instrumental.
Yeah, we'll
so anyway, then there's things like Jean-Pierre Melville, who I quote. There is certainly Seijin Suzuki, the Japanese director, who I quote. I like quotations. I like taking things from other places. I think anything should be free to be reappropriated. You know, if you take someone's idea and then realize it before they do and steal it, you're an ass. But if you take something from another place and make it yours, that's the history of human expression. I don't know if you guys saw the Eno film yet, but that's a very, you know, important, he's an important, I don't know, he defined that idea that groups of people are not, it's not individual geniuses, it's like certain confluences. And I kind of came of age in the New York City, you know, punk, post-punk thing, and it was a lot of diverse bands, but it was like one thing elevating off because of, like you were saying, you know, birds that fly intricate formations in a group cannot physically often perform those same maneuvers alone. And I know that sometimes musicians in large Western classical orchestras will say, oh man, you know, I play at a different level when I'm with that orchestra. It's something we can't really analyze. And I thought it was a kind of funny juxtaposition with the kind of crumbling code of honor of the American, you know, organized crime stuff.
which was fading at the time. I mean, they were not predominantly that powerful, which they were in the 50s and 60s. So, like in the 90s, it was a little bit different. And so, your depiction of the Italian mafia in New York is comical in this, in a way. And was that reflective of things that you were seeing at the time, or in terms of the mafia in New York City?
I got to say, I lived in the very late 70s, 78, 79. I had a sublet, an apartment on Mulberry Street. And on the top floor, and I could look down at the activity on the street outside the Ravenite Social Club, which was John Gotti's social club. Yeah. So I'd see John Gotti and Neil de la Croce, and I saw these guys on the street all the time. And I had an encounter because I took pictures of them from the roof at one point. And then one of them, I'm not sure who it was, it wasn't Sammy the Bull, but it might have been Neil de la Croce, in fact, who on the street said, "Hey, kid, come over here. I had to talk to you about something. You live up there?" I'm like, "Yes." "You take a lot of pictures?" "Yeah." "Yeah, don't do that. You know, I've seen you do that. Let's just have an agreement. You understand me? No more pictures." I'm like, I understand you, sir. And I didn't take any more pictures from the roof.
Message received.
So
I do want to ask about Forest Whitaker's performance in this, and the casting of Forest Whitaker, and how that collaboration came to be about. It's a fantastic role for him. Did you write this role with him in mind, or how is it that you two came together to collaborate on this film?
Okay, well, let's try to make it short, but I did some things with Neil Young, and I used Super 8 film, and I made a video for Crazy Horse, Broken Arrow, and Neil was into Super 8 stuff, and then I made Year of the Horse partly in Super 8. Yeah. So there's a place in LA in the Valley, it was called Super 8 Sound, I think they've changed the name, but they would load any existing material and cut it and sprocket it for Super 8 cartridges, right? So I was there getting some stuff or something with Neil, I don't know. And in the parking lot, I meet Forrest Whitaker. And he has a beautiful little Super 8 camera, and he's buying some film material. And we're out in this parking lot in the Valley, and I'm like, "Yo, you're Forrest." He's like, "Man, you're Jim." And I'm like, "Yeah." So then we just were talking about Super 8 stuff, and we were talking and talking. And then he said, "If you ever want to do something with me, man, let me know. Keep me in mind, you know?" And I was already just at the beginning of gathering these disparate things to collage, but I didn't have it yet. I do all of my films, I gather details over some years often, and I don't quite know yet what they're going to be, but I just start finding things, right? And so my mind went kind of wild. So then I came back to LA several times as I was writing the script just to talk with Forrest. And I told him, "Yeah, I'm writing something with you in mind, you know?" And so I would come back and check things out. And so he was Ghost Dog, you know? He, in a way, engendered the film by saying that, "Hey, if you ever think of me for something." And then
did you have that character fully formed before that conversation happened?
No, not fully formed.
So that informed the casting.
Yeah, it was a bit hazy. I was still forming it, you know. So yeah, so then I got to do this with Forrest, who's remarkably Ghost Dog like during the shooting. And at one point we were shooting and it was very, very cold, and he had a tiny little room in the part of a trailer because we didn't have a big budget, right? So he was in there all night and I didn't get to shoot with him. I was shooting other stuff and he was waiting the whole night, you know? It was freezing in there. So I go in there at the end of the night to say, "Man, I'm so sorry, Forrest. We had some camera issues, some things went wrong." And I said, "Yeah, I would never do that to you. You know, I had these problems." And he said, "You know, that's cool. I meditated. I read some things. I'm very calm. I used my time." Wow. I was like, "Whoa." I thought he would have bitten me, you know, but he was just like that, you know, very dedicated. He did get very mad at me, though, once, because I made him eat a lot of ice cream and he had a bad reaction. And he got a sugar thing, and he got really mad at me. And the next day, he called me, and like he was like, "No more ice cream, man." I went into sugar shock. I was like, "No more ice cream. We got it all, you know."
Was the use of the French language in the film an homage to Melville?
No, it was more the idea that you can understand people without knowing the language.
Yeah,
sometimes.
That was a beautiful relationship in that way.
Yeah, and I learned this thing when I've been to Japan like 9 times, you know, and when I went early on, I was really obsessed with Japanese cinema, but you couldn't get VHS tapes here, right? That's just what it was then. So I go to Japan and bring back all these VHS tapes of Mitsuguchi and Naruse and Suzuki and, of course, Ozu. And they had no subtitles. So I'd watch them endlessly, and I learned I could follow. Okay, I couldn't follow all the details of the dialogue, obviously, but I could fully follow the actor, you know, the feelings, right, the things that were happening. I could follow the emotional arc of the stories. And, you know, because the acting's in the eyes and the details. And so that was very interesting. And then I thought, well, why do they have to know what they're saying? Plus, I had a couple of French girlfriends in my life, and I didn't always know what the hell they were saying, you know? But it didn't make me less attracted to them, so.
I'd heard the story about you meeting Roberto Benigni on a film jury, and you didn't really speak each other's language. But
that's right.
But that's how you two connected. And when I saw the Ghost Dog, I found that reminiscent of hearing you.
Oh, we talked endlessly in broken French. And
right.
French people had heard
so no
us.
Italian, no English, but you found a commonality.
Yeah.
And it
yes.
was yeah.
And we just fell in love with our exchanging ideas with each other. So.
That's really beautiful that happens sometimes.
And I still talk to Roberto almost once a month. And
you do?
Oh, yeah. I'll call him the phone on Sundays. And
for
he
Italian
talks
dinner?
Very, very loud. Hello, Jim! I want to see you across the ocean now. It's very loud. I'm like, hey, Bob, how you doing? I want to smell you. You know. Yeah, I don't know about that, Bob, but I love him. He's really one of my favorite strange individuals, you know.
Today on Think Twice, we are featuring a conversation with Yellow Springs Film Festival chief programmer Eric Mahoney and director Jim Jarmusch. The conversation followed a showing of his 1999 film Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. In today's last segment, from the question and answer portion of the event, Jarmusch reflects on his long partnership with cinematographer Robbie Mueller and the nature of his collaborations with actors.
Yeah, well, he shot Down by Law and Mystery Train, Ghost Dog. He shot Dead Man. He was my, like, older brother, teacher, mentor. And I learned so much from him about photography, about keeping your antenna up, about thinking on your feet, about knowing that when you shoot a film, you only have that one moment in that one place to do that one take. The next will be different. He taught me to ignore constraints. We always made shot lists. I'd never use storyboards. So we would always do shot lists and on before the day of the shoot, and on the day of the shoot, we throw them away. And we rethink what it is. He did things like we'd be scouting locations for Dead Man and see these beautiful calendar-like vistas out west. And Robbie would say, okay, that's no good. We would turn our back on that, and then we'd see a disfigured tree and some rocks, and he said, this. And he taught me these things, and also to always, like, if you're shooting, okay, you have a scene in the script and it's not supposed to rain, but we're shooting and it's raining. And Robbie's first inclination, most productions is, okay, we can't shoot in the rain. And Robbie's always like, maybe it's better in the rain, you know? Let's like think, how can we use this? What do we think? Yeah. And he taught me very much about all the different ways to use black and white. It's not one way. I just loved him. He taught me a lot about a lot of things. And he was also very teenage-like in his anti-authoritarianism and his whole attitude was very anti-authority, let's say. And I just loved him so much. So.
Such a beautiful artist. And again, the collaboration then that spawns from those conversations about let's use this and not this, and this is happening today, and maybe we just go with this instead. And You know,
well, it's about being alive and thinking on your feet.
And open, you know? yeah.
But it was difficult, too. Once we're shooting Dead Man, and he said, you know, why are we breaking for lunch? I'm losing all the f***ing light. We have limited time. I don't want to break for lunch. So I'm like, okay, I stay up all night organizing the next day walk-on lunch so different departments can eat while others are working. So the next day we're shooting, and Robbie says, why are these people standing around eating f***ing sandwiches? And aren't we breaking for lunch, you know? So he had some difficult elements, but he was really one of my great kind of teachers and friends. So a master. And an intuitive master. You know, it is totally varied on the people I'm collaborating with and what I consider to be their strengths. So it's a very different every time, and I have to evaluate those things to proceed. I personally love it when they want to play, and I'm most thrilled when they want to improvise. But like I had Gulshifteh Farahani and Adam Driver, I gave them a script to Patterson. Is there anything you want to change? And they said, no, we're doing the script. And they did. So I was like, it's just my crummy writing for the... Aren't you going to help me out here? But and other actors are brilliant at improvising, and others are not. So I try to find the chemistry. In my new film, Tom Waits plays the father of Adam Driver and Mayim Bialik, who are kind of straight, the two kids. And they're visiting their father, who's a reclusive, sort of a con man, you know? And so on the first day of shooting, Adam and Mayim are very precise actors, and they just did the script, right? And after the first day of shooting, Tom took me aside and said, I don't know, Jim, you hired these two professional killers here. What am I doing? I don't know. And I'm like, Tom, your strength is not that. You know, you just trust me. And it's like, I trust you, but they're going to assassinate me, you know? So it's very different. I had one actor on Dead Man named Michael Wincott, a wonderful actor, who we would play a game where I would say, okay, I want you to throw the dialogue out here and think up something for this scene, and don't tell me. If you get something good, you know, go think, and then if you get something good, then tell me that we'll shoot it, you know? So one time, we had the camera way up in a tree. Our assistant camera climbed the tree with those kind of things that guys that climb telephone poles use this. Yeah. And he went up there with the camera. So we're in a woods somewhere, I don't know where, in Oregon. And the thing is, there are three guys riding horseback under this shot. And as through the space of them passing through, I just wanted one little, some dialogue from Michael about the fact that it's getting darker out. That it's dusk, right? So I tell Michael, if you can think up something. He goes off, he walks around, he comes back. Yeah, I got something, man, I got something good. So they're riding under the shot, and perfectly timed in the shot, he says something like, well, aren't you glad the sun goes down kind of gradual-like? Because, man, what if it just went out all of a sudden, man? That'd scare the shit out of me, you know? And he times it right to go through the shot, like so beautiful. I couldn't write that. And so there's actors like that. I worked with Robert Mitchum. Mr. Mitchum does not improvise, you know? So they're all very different. You have to find your way. And being a director, you are a psychologist. You are a parent. Actors are your children. Because actors, I'm very sympathetic, actors have to be a pretend person on command using what as tools? Their own emotions and their personal history. And most actors are people that are deprived of attention or something, you know? They're particular. And so I protect them. And I've had actors have a burnout or run off crying or have an emotional thing. And my attitude is, well, how could they not, man? Yeah. I gotta go get them. They're my people, you know, they're my collaborators. And so I'm very, very sensitive to what their strengths are and how we can make something together. And Riz and Jizza improvised some stuff in that.
Did you write the line, you're Bill Ghost Bustin' Murray?
No, I had the line where he's like, yeah, don't tell anyone, you know, that comes in and they're like, yeah, but yo, you're Bill Murray, you know, and also I still to this day call Bill Murray, always.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Bill Murray, you know, I call, yeah, he calls on the phone. Hey, what's up, Bill Murray? He's used to it now. And also, you know, I think Riz and Jizza too, they saw him like, hey, Bill Murray, you know.
The question was about Jim scores his own films. She was talking about Only Lovers Left Alive and how that process is. Sorry, just to clarify.
Yeah, and again, they're all particular. Only Lovers Left Alive is a film about vampires that have been alive a long time. And I was trying to celebrate appreciation for old things, human expression from the past, and modern things thrown in. So the musical dichotomy immediately was my friend Josef van Wissem, who's a lutenist. We've made a number of records together, and I make kind of drony, gnarly, feedback-ish landscapes behind his kind of crystalline, beautiful little lute things that are often palindromic in structure. And he's kind of a trip. I love him. But we like this disparate thing that worked for the film, so that was the concept from the beginning. And then I got to have my band's kind of drone rock, damaged sounding stuff with his kind of crystalline. It was a great, lutes have a lot of strings, right? And the joke is, we tease Josef that lute players spend half their lives tuning and the other half playing out of tune, you know? So, but he's great. Once on my, we're on the same record label, Two Sacred Bones. Once on my spell check, I was texting Josef van Wissem, and it came out Josef van Nuisance. And so I call him that always now. And now the head of our record label, Kayla Bratton, also calls him that. Because he's quite particular, Josef, you know. But we have a new record in the works, me and Josef.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, we got one. It's on the stove.
We talked about Qigong for a second. I shared with Jim last night that I have a Qigong routine that I do, and I only do it to that soundtrack for the last 10 years. I think it's the most fitting.
And one of the last times I got to see Lou Reed, who I kind of knew, he said, hey, man, I made this record of electronic. It's called Hudson River Meditations, and I use it for my Tai Chi. And I want to send it to you. And I said, wow, thanks, man. I wrote down my address, and you know. And 3 days later, I got the CD, and I used that sometimes. I said, Lou, are you going to release this or anything? And he said, no, no, it's just for practicing the discipline of this. It's only for people going that way. It's pretty cool. Long live Lou. Everyone said he was very cranky and difficult, which he was with journalists and all that, but he was always so nice to me in my encounters. But can I tell the three question interview with Lou on YouTube that was from Germany, maybe around the rock and roll animal period. And the first question is, so Mr. Lou Reed, you are now a big rock star. Do you want to be a big famous rock star, Mr. Lou Reed? And Lou says, yeah. Question number two, so as a big rock star, you know, you can make lots and lots of money and be a rich, wealthy, you know, famous person. Is this what you'd like? Yeah. And then the last question, so Mr. Lou Reed, when you have amassed all of this great wealth and you have money that you can spend how you please, what will you spend it on? Drugs. And that was the end of the interview. I have to say, though, there's a beautiful song of the Velvets called Ocean. It's very beautiful. But one of the lines that's not included in most recordings at the end is, you know you feel so strong, but you know it won't be long till it's all underwater. And it's the end of Ocean, and it's not in a lot of the versions, but a little Lou Reed asides.
Well, I could do this all night, honestly. I mean, I am such a big fan. I interned for Jim 18 years ago in New York City when I moved there. I wrote him a letter, and he was very gracious to let me come and work in his office. And so that's how much I love and appreciate your work. And thank you so much for being here.
I want to just take a selfish question because not only am I such a big fan of yours.
Yeah, I don't have the money I owe you right now. I'm working on it.
Yeah. Well, the interest has accumulated over 18 years substantially. Do you understand that? But I'm a big, big fan of all the people that you collaborate to, and I'm a big, big Tom Waits fan. Love Tom Waits as I do Iggy Pop, as I do Neil Young, and so your taste and my tastes are very much aligned. And I would just love to ask before we leave, can you give us a good Tom Waits story?
Oh man, I don't know where should I start with Tom Waits. I've spent a lot of wacky situations with Tom. Yeah. One time I was staying with him at his house in Northern California, and I said, let's go to the movies, you know, in the nearest town, right? And he said, okay, they're having a John Candy festival, which of course they weren't because Tom, you know. So we went and saw a Paul Schrader film, Light Sleeper, and in the middle of, and there were like four of us in the theater, us and like two ladies, you know? And in the middle of the film, the Paul Schrader film, they mentioned John Candy. And I was like, Tom's like, see what I mean? But I've had so many adventures. One time we were driving with his very young children in his Cadillac, and he said, okay, kids, I'm gonna give you a 30-second free time when you can swear as much as you want. Because in their house they have a swear jar. And if you swear, you had to put a quarter in, right? So when I first arrived, Tom's like, I got you covered. I put $5 in. So you got a little leeway, but these are my children, you know? And they were pretty little, the children. So he's like, all right, when you're ready, free time swearing. And they were little kids, right? So it's like, okay, now. And they're going, poop, vomit. You know, they had no clue how to swear. That was very endearing, so. And one time we went to pick up his wife, or had bought this gigantic wagon wheels, and we had to go get them in Tom's 1964 El Camino. So we got them in there with some guy's help. They weighed a ton. So we're driving, and somehow Tom's rear tires are on fire, literally. And I look back and say, yo, Tom, man, we got a problem. You know, we got smoke coming off the tires. He's like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? Those are new tires. So I said, pull the f*** over, man. He pulls over and he runs out, and there's a guy watering his lawn there. And the tires are on fire, and Tom runs and takes this man's hose and hoses off the tires, which then explode. And this man's there like, what the hell? Who are these freaky guys in this thing, you know? But yeah, I've had many, many experiences. I won't tell you the Gambino family one. I got too many. But that guy's amazing. And a lot of strange experience with Tom. Here's a beautiful one. When we were shooting Down by Law, we had the use of a car for the film briefly, a beautiful, this is in 1985 or whatever, a beautiful black Jaguar that we're using, that it's part of the plot where he, so we have this Jag. So late at night, Tom and I'd go in the production office for the 3 nights we had the car and take the keys. And we go out cruising in this Jaguar, and Tom drives like an autistic person. He has one arm out that guides all the other traffic, you know, as though he controls the world. Yeah, go ahead, pass me. I don't know. And he reads every sign of everything, you know? Poor boy, po' boy's 250. Look, Betty's glamour box, get your hair done. And it's so beautiful. But the thing was, we had one cassette in the car, which was Julie London singing Cry Me a River. So this was our soundtrack. And on our third night, I said, you know, Tom, this is the only f-ing song we have. What are you thinking? He said, well, what more do you need? And so that was our soundtrack, Julie London. I still have a fondness for that recording. And many Tom Waits stories. Because Tom always, you never know, I've known him a long time, and I never know, is he telling me the truth?
Yeah.
Or is he inventing this thing? Jim, do you know there's a deep sea fish called the hagfish with 8 rows of razor sharp teeth and a face that looks like Buddy Hackett? And I'm like, come on, Tom, just, I'm not falling for that. Then he pulls out a photograph, hagfish, you know? And I'm like, oh, I don't know, what's this guy? A really fascinating human being, too. And I love that he does, and I'm sorry to keep going on, but he does interviews where he never answers the question. So it's so great. Like, so, Tom, what was your inspiration for this song? Do you know there's a colony of albino moles under Las Vegas that have formed their housing into the shape of a condominium? You know, I don't know where his brain gets these things, but...
Jim.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you so much, man. You're the man. You're the man. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And thanks to...
Director Jim Jarmusch speaking with Eric Mahoney at last fall's Yellow Springs Film Festival. This year's festival begins October 2nd. Complete information is available at ysfilmfest.com. The new Jim Jarmusch movie featuring Tom Waits that was referred to in the last segment is titled Father, Mother, Sister, Brother and recently debuted at the Venice Film Festival. Special thanks to Eric Mahoney and Jim Jarmusch for Think Twice on WYSO. I'm Dave Barber. Thanks for listening.